Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the program, actor, writer, director, and producer Jon Favreau talks about his latest movie, Chef, with our film contributor Dan Hudak. Music contributor Bob Weinberg previews the Miami International Jazz Fest with founder Arturo Campa. Chef Norman Van Aken serves up a word on food, and our Florida Keys calendar features Andy Newman. Founded in 2004, the Haitian Heritage Museum has celebrated its first decade of creating a legacy for future generations. With us today to talk about the museum's great success is the founder and executive director, author and lecturer, Ms. Evelyn Pierre. And we welcome you back to South Florida Arts Beat. Ms. Pierre?
Thank you, Ed, for having me. This is such a wonderful treat for me today.
Tell us, other than co-founder Mr. Serge Rodriguez, who was there to help you get the museum started over 10 years ago?
Wow, you can never take all of this responsibility on your own. You have such great people around you, and you're only as good as the people around you. So we had a wonderful, good group of advisory board members, great executive board members. One of the persons that's been around with us from day one, his name is Evan St. Fort. We actually had a wonderful, he's executive board member. We also had advisory board member Dr. Rudy Moise. We also had Philip Brutus. So we had a lot of great people who's been around with us from the beginning to help get us to the next level.
Now, in your first decade, how has the museum grown? By leaps and bounds, apparently.
Yes, by leaps and bounds, because we just kept at it. Because when you have a passion to do something that has never been done before, particularly the first Haitian Heritage Museum, there's a lot of nuts and bolts that you don't know. But as you continue on the journey and you have these big lofty ideas, you get the idea that you have to do it right and you want to be sustainable and you want to be here way after when you're gone that the museum is standing. So we actually went from just doing educational programming to now, you know, dabbling into technology, having a great outreach program, and continuing to do wonderful exhibitions and partnering up with the National Museum of Haiti, which is MUPANA. We've done our third exhibition with them and getting artifacts and getting our collection digitizing. As we speak right now, we're getting our collection digitizing. So not only it can just be beneficial to the people here in South Florida, but globally.
Oh, that's a great idea. That's a great idea. Tell us about some of the exhibitions you've presented over the past 10 years.
Well, we did one that was called Chemin Liberté. Chemin Liberté, if I can translate for you guys, is
Please.
The Road to Freedom. And that exhibition came directly from the National Museum of Haiti. We also did an exhibition called Natif Natav. Natif Natav is really meaning the native language, the native tongue of Haitian, and basically of Haitian Creole. And it was a very, it was a very art-related exhibition, and it had a lot of masters, like old pieces from the 1950s and 1940s, so you can really get a strong understanding of Haitian art. We also did an exhibition called Les Jacmeliens. Les Jacmeliens meaning it's an area located in Haiti, which is Jacmel, Haiti, and basically it's the art district in Haiti.
Ah.
So since we're in the design district in South Florida, we felt it would be very important to kind of show the distinction of the art district of Jacmel, Haiti, and show how it can be just as on the same level as the art district here in South Florida, which is the Miami Design District, to kind of show that compare and contrast.
Wonderful. Do I understand, correct me, that you have a permanent exhibition on the history of Haiti? I've seen that in photos. I don't know if that's exactly what that was.
The Chemin Liberté, well, because the space, we kind of outgrew our space. When we have our exhibition, we can't really have the permanent collection there as we show the new exhibition. So we kind of do a lot of rotations. And our rotations are quarter, we change it out. So we just did this Les Jacmeliens Trois, which we're rotating it out. We did it for Art Basel, and now we're getting ready to do Toussaint Louverture, which is, that's an awesome exhibition that's taking place May the 9th.
Oh, marvelous.
And we want everybody to come out.
Yes, indeed. We're speaking with Ms. Evelyn Pierre, the executive director, the founder of the Haitian Heritage Museum. It's located at 4141 Northeast 2nd Avenue in Miami, and you can find out more information at HaitianHeritageMuseum.org and on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
Twitter is Haitian Heritage Museum. On Instagram is Haitian Heritage Museum as well.
Good, good, good. Facebook, too, Haitian Heritage Museum.
Facebook is Haitian Heritage Museum as well.
Wonderful. Now, tell me about any interaction you might have with kids, with the Miami-Dade Public Schools. I'm sure there's a lot going on.
Sure, sure, sure. We've been partnering up with the Miami-Dade County Public School since 2008. Mm. And we have a program that's called IET Exposé. And we also participate in the Cultural Passport Program. With the IET Exposé, since, you know, we've been around for so long, we wanted to kind of continue on with the trend that is happening in South Florida and the trend that's happening around the world in education, because everything is now technology-based. Mm. So instead of just doing IET Exposé, which we had to go into the schools, you know, have the museum educator go into the schools and give the outreach program, now we have a program that's called EIET Exposé, where the museum educator actually comes to the museum, and then all the different schools, like four different schools, can feed on at the same time.
Wow.
And log on, and we can tackle, like, you know, 160 kids at one time without leaving the museum. So that's wonderful. And we also use Skype. And of course, we definitely are heavily into social media, because again, we want to equip our children to be equipped for the future and stop the digital divide, because when you look at it, the minorities are actually behind with the technology, and we want to make sure that our kids, our South Florida kids, have like a stepping stone to be right there in the room and be well equipped.
Wonderful. How can South Florida, our wonderful listeners, help you out in these great areas?
Well, our wish list for the Haitian Heritage Museum, we definitely want more artifacts. If you have any artifacts in your home that you feel that it could be something that we can have in our museum to kind of continue to build our collection as we continue to grow, that would be wonderful. We also need some volunteers. We need volunteers. We're having, like I told you, the event that's taking place on May the 9th, which is next week Friday, at the Haitian Heritage Museum at 6:30 p.m. We need volunteers to help us with the group of people that will come to the museum. And we also need, like, daily volunteers. If you're at home and you're a retiree and you want to come and support the Haitian community and support the Haitian Heritage Museum, you don't have to speak Creole, because we speak English as well. And we would love to have you.
That's marvelous. And you can get in touch once again with the Haitian Heritage Museum at 305-371-5988. Once again, online at HaitianHeritageMuseum.org. Now, after the May 9th event, what future exhibitions are coming your way?
After the May 9th event, we're going to actually have the fourth installation of Le Jacques Millien 4. And let me just translate. I just said Le Jacques Millien 4, meaning 4, which is going to also continue doing Art Basel. We're going to show again the district of the Jacques Mel of the arts, and of course the district of Miami Design District, because when we have Art Basel come here to South Florida, there's like thousands of people that come, and we want to make sure that we're on that platform.
Yeah.
To showcase Haitian art, because again, so much is going on, and we don't want to miss that opportunity to kind of show our culture in a different light, because Haitian art is not just primitive. We have a lot of contemporary stuff that we want to show the people.
Wonderful, wonderful. So you can log on, of course, to Haitian Heritage Museum. Can people subscribe and get a regular newsletter? Do you offer something along those lines, or press releases, certainly?
Yes, we do. We have a newsletter. If you can, send your information to hhmevents@comcast.net. We'll definitely put you on our newsletter. We'll get you on the lifeblood of what's going on with the museum. And you can also become a member. We have different levels of membership that's on our website as well. And anything that you would need, just definitely contact us at hhmevents, or you can get us at HaitianHeritageMuseum.org, and then we can kind of follow up with you. And then you did mention about one thing at the beginning of the show. You mentioned who else was there to help us get to where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be remiss if I didn't mention these two art gurus here in South Florida. One, I would like to thank Mr. Craig Robbins, the gentleman behind DACRA. He's doing phenomenal things, and he's just been such a strong supporter of the museum from day one. And the other angel that we have is Bob Goodman, who is actually the Miami Beach representative of Art Basel. He's phenomenal. He's basically my mentor. And I just want to thank those two gentlemen because they have been so behind the project. And just give me so much wisdom that I couldn't get in school. You know, I just got on the job training, and they've just been so open to helping the Haitian community and, of course, helping me.
Well, it's a marvelous effort, over 10 years strong. We congratulate Ms. Evelyn Pierre, our guest today, executive director and founder of the Haitian Heritage Museum. Once again, 4141 Northeast 2nd Avenue in Miami. Call 305-371-5988. HaitianHeritageMuseum.org. They're also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Haitian Heritage Museum. And thank you so much for joining us, Evelyn. It was great. We want to have you back soon.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the program, music contributor Bob Weinberg previews the Miami International Jazz Fest with founder Arturo Campa. Chef Norman Van Aken delivers a word on food, and our Florida Keys calendar features Andy Newman. Now, our film contributor Dan Hudak previews a new film with an all-star cast, partially shot right here in South Florida.
This is a true story. When I arrived for the press screening of writer-director star Jon Favreau's Chef, which is about a talented chef struggling to find his way, the fire alarm was going off as smoke filled the Regal South Beach Theater. The oil for the popcorn caught fire, we were told. You could smell the burnt popcorn while standing outside the theater at the intersection of Alton and Lincoln, and before long we learned the theater wouldn't reopen that night. No biggie. The heat at a playoff game I was missing and studio-distributed online screener links looked pretty good on my television. With the irony of burnt food preventing me from seeing a movie about delicious food behind me, Chef was a real delight. Favreau wears a number of hats, literally, in the lead role of Carl Casper, an uber-talented chef whose creativity is stifled by his domineering and money-driven boss, played by Dustin Hoffman. Buoyed by Sofia Vergara as his ex-wife, John Leguizamo as a sous chef, and a bit of financing from a Lausch played by Robert Downey Jr. in a quick cameo, Carl opens a food truck selling media noches in Miami, then proceeds to other locales on his way to Los Angeles.
You're never going to be happy cooking for someone else.
Food truck's a great idea. We're talking about a white-on-white 88 Chevy Grumman food truck. It's a blank canvas for your dreams. I'm going to have him pull it around.
Thank you.
Don't thank me till you see it.
So what are you going to do?
You're going to laugh.
Tony, Carl's got a taco truck.
For real?
I was so jealous when I heard your voice. I was like, that's what I want to do.
Favreau shot the film on location across the southern United States, including at the Fontainebleau, Little Havana, and South Beach right here in Miami. Though it is a warm and effective story that's very well told, the highlight of Chef is, not surprisingly, the food, which looks mouthwateringly delicious. For this, Favreau consulted with noted chef and food truck entrepreneur Roy Choi, who also insisted that none of the food go to waste. Sometimes it's a real treat to work on a Hollywood movie set. With Chef ready to open in South Florida May 16th, I recently sat down with Favreau, who also directed Iron Man and Elf, at the Fontainebleau to discuss shooting in Miami, cooking, and his creative approach in small projects versus large Hollywood productions. So we're here at the Fontainebleau.
Yes.
Admit it. You shot those two scenes at the Fontainebleau just so we can come back now months later for the press day here. So you get more time here.
That's right. I get treated well here. You know why I did it, really? Because when I stayed in the Fontainebleau, they have a little loop that runs on your television when you turn it on that shows clips from all the movies that have filmed here, back to like Goldfinger and The Bodyguard, and hopefully we'll be part of that little loop of best of clips.
And The Sopranos filmed here too?
Yes,
a lot
that's
of
right.
stuff is
that's
shot
right.
down here.
Yeah, and this is a place, you know, I'm from New York, and I remember it was a big deal when, you know, people would go to the Fontainebleau back in like the 60s, 70s. My grandfather came down and stole an ashtray, and I remember looking at that ashtray. So it was, to me, that was the best ashtray they ever lost, because that was the one that really built up the brand in my mind.
And you also shot at other locations throughout South Florida, Little Havana.
Yeah.
And you shot in Texas, Austin, Texas, that's New right. Orleans,
yeah.
kind of all over the place. Was that part of the process as well? Like, hey, I can travel the country with this movie too.
Oh, like that's why I did it?
Yeah.
Well, it was kind of. I mean, look, it's you're doing the whole thing took a month, and it was a mad dash to get it done. So you're not really enjoying life as a tourist mm-hmm. when you're directing a little movie like this. However, the idea, the romance of showing all the coolest cities that the guy's sharing with his kid on a road trip and being able to introduce the audience to the backdrop of these great places,
yeah.
that's really exciting. And I remember back from the days of Swingers that you want to get the authentic world that you're presenting. You can't afford a lot of things, a little one, but you can afford to run around. And because you're low profile, you could slip into places when they're open and take advantage of shooting on Abbot Kinney in Venice during First Friday, which mm-hmm. is when all the food trucks yeah. are lined up, and just actually film while it's going on and not try to control it. So that was kind of fun. And of course, you know, I love Austin. I visited Little Havana when I was working on Iron Man 3 here, and I went to that place that we feature called Hoy Como Ayer, saw some great Cuban music, had some great Cuban yeah. food, and I thought, this would be such a great setting for a scene in a movie. And so it popped into my head as I wrote this. And of course, New Orleans and the Marigny, and just hearing, you know, that brassy jazz sound and eating beignets and introducing right. your kid to all that stuff seemed like a really romantic notion.
Does it ever feel overwhelming writing, producing, starring, and directing all those roles at once?
It does. You know, I think whatever you're used to, you want to try something different then. And working on the big movies, it's exciting because you have all the toys and these great movie stars you're working with and a studio that's supporting you and supportive of you. And, you know, especially like around the time of Iron Man 2, whenever we would come out, people would give us room to come out, and there was, you know, you knew that you had at least a weekend to yourself. And there's a lot of security in that. But it's also fun once in a while to come out and just, you know, like do a solo album and mm-hmm. be able to write and perform the music that you want to. And so it's stressful because there's a lot of responsibility, but it's a fairly short run compared to the 2 years it takes to make a big movie. This one, we filmed it in a month. There's a lot of time in the editing room and certainly not a lot of resources to get everything you dream of. But, you know, I come out of independent film. I'm used to working with limited means, and it was fun to get back into that mode and just bring a lot of energy to something and just power through it.
Does your approach differ if you're doing something like this or Iron Man or Elf? Because they're three very different genres.
Sure.
As you come to it, are you in a different mind frame, or is it always the same?
Well, I think certain things strategically it's different, but as far as my sensibility, one of the things I like about the fact that I've done those three different types of movies is if you listen to the dialogue and the style of comedy, I think they all share some common DNA. There's a naturalism mm-hmm. to it. There's a dryness to the humor. I think the jokes, although they might be much more broad in Elf, I think there's a subtlety to it that I really enjoy as an audience member and I try to present. So, you know, I think there's a common voice to all of them, but strategically, this one is much different. There were a few sequences in Elf, like when we're running around the streets in New York and mm-hmm. he's dressed in the Elf suit. You know, we shot that real run and gun with just a van and a camera, and Will Ferrell is very courageous and just would jump out in that suit anywhere. And then we'd run up with releases to people and get right. people to sign. But other than that, everything was meticulously planned, especially the effects work. In this one, this was more that style, and the style that we did Swingers or Made, where you just kind of got it done and got it with as much energy as possible.
And how much time in pre-production do you spend on an Iron Man or one of those effects-driven movies?
You know,
it seems like there'd be a lot more there than
it's
on
a lot.
Other projects.
You know, here in Jungle, I'm working on Jungle Book now, and that one has a lot of, you know, there's so many, there's character design, you're designing environments, you have a whole story department doing pencil sketches and putting animatics together, and, you know, that's years. It's years. And then the actual element shoot itself isn't as long, but so much planning goes into it and coordinating, so everybody's has the same vision for what you're doing, and that's your job as a director, is making sure people share a vision, a common vision. The vision could change, and it could come from different people, different people can contribute to it, but you want to make sure everybody's making the same movie. Movie like this, you know, you have a few department heads. These people are tend to be understaffed because there's just not a lot of money to go around, so you have people working twice as hard for a very short amount of time. And it adds to a certain excitement, and there's a, you know, a, definitely a sense of satisfaction when you complete it, even though it's short. You really feel like you left it on the field. You feel like you're doing the two-minute drill the whole time.
Yeah, I got to ask, the food in this movie looks unbelievably delicious. How much do you cook?
I cook a lot now. So much of the training was about really learning how to look like you knew what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Roy Choi took this on and agreed to really do beyond what I had hoped in designing the menu and overseeing, you know, looking at the script and coming to the editing room. And a big part of it was putting me through the training to look like a real chef. And that consisted of me getting a pretty concentrated traditional French culinary training, as my character would have done. Mm-hmm. And so that was, you know, the knife skills, you know, julienne tournée, and then mother sauces, and breaking down a chicken, and you know, and making demi-glace, and all those things that my guy would have experienced. And then only after that, Roy Choi let me into his kitchen as a prep cook, and then eventually working the line during service. Wow. For a few months, I was going in and out of his kitchens, and then practicing all the stuff at home. And then the kids would, you know, especially my seven-year-old would see me practicing cutting up vegetables, and that's like arts and crafts. And so she wanted to do it too, and it turned into like Tom Sawyer with all of us doing it together, painting the fence. And now that it's done, I still like doing it. And now I'm putting in a commercial kitchen and ripping out all the beautiful residential stuff and putting in stainless steel and open shelving and a wok ring and a pizza oven. It's just really become part of our social life and our home life.
Now please tell me that food that we see in the movie was eaten by the staff and the crew.
That was a big deal, especially with Roy, because, you know, chefs are all about respecting the product. And
sure.
And often, like if you're doing a commercial, the food stylist will spray glycerin on it to make it shiny. It looks great, but you can't eat it after that.
Right.
And it just was so counter to what this whole movie was about. So even when we're breaking down the pig, everything was... You know, we made sure that everything was sanitary and stuff was parceled out and given to the crew. So there were a lot of good barbecues after that scene. And of course, all the food you saw was delicious. It was overseen by Roy. He was there every day. We were working with food. And not a lot went to waste. There wasn't a lot of people eating at catering at lunch because we were all full on food days.
Yeah, would you? It
was amazing.
Mouthwatering.
It was amazing.
Jon Favreau, the movie is Chef. It opens May 16th. Thank you for your thoughts.
My pleasure.
You're a pro.
Jon Favreau's Chef starts serving theaters May 16th. For South Florida Arts Beat, I'm Dan Hudak.
Chairman Emeritus of the Florida Film Critics Circle, Dan Hudak is a nationally syndicated film critic. You can visit him online at hudakonhollywood.com. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will continue right after these messages. It's South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Coming up on the show, Chef Norman Van Aken cooks up a word on food, and Andy Newman delivers his Florida Keys calendar. Now, music contributor Bob Weinberg takes a look at what people are hoping will turn out to be an annual South Florida jazz offering.
The irresistible sounds of clave, son, and tumbao will echo from venues in Little Haiti and South Miami as the first ever Miami International Jazz Festival rolls into town. Headliners Jerry Gonzalez and the Fort Apache Band and Giovanni Hidalgo and Atlanti will anchor the event, which will also include South Florida jazz stars Mike Orta and Abel Pabon and the funky multi-ethnic jam crew of the Spam All-Stars. Conceived by musician and producer Arturo Campa, the festival will be presented at the Little Haiti Cultural Arts Center and at the South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center on May 9th and 10th. Campa's name may be familiar to fans of Latin jazz. He was the lead vocalist with the Eddie Palmieri Orchestra in the late 60s and early 70s, and founded the Miami Latin Jazz Fest in the mid to late 90s to raise funds for the preservation of the historic Gusman Performing Arts Center. Campa also served as associate producer of the short-lived JVC Jazz Festival on Miami Beach and has presented a who's who of jazz artists on area stages, from Mango Santamaria, Potato Valdez, and Cachao, to George Benson, Tony Bennett, and Cassandra Wilson. New York-born trumpeter and conga player Jerry Gonzalez also came to prominence with Eddie Palmieri's band. While he's recorded in various contexts over the years, Gonzalez is best known for his Fort Apache band, the quintet he started with his bass-playing brother, Andy Gonzalez, and the late drummer Steve Berrios. The group integrates Afro-Caribbean jazz with bop and hard bop, a sizzling combination that's won them international acclaim. Among the world's most respected congueros, Giovanni Hidalgo hails from San Juan, Puerto Rico. A generation younger than Gonzalez, he incorporates rhythms he learned from his stint in Cuba with the group Batacumbele. Like Gonzalez and Campa, he performed with Eddie Palmieri and was then recruited by Dizzy Gillespie to play with the United Nations Jazz Orchestra. Since then, Hidalgo has taught at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, been honored at the Puerto Rico Heineken Jazz Festival, and recently worked in a quartet with pianist Gonzalo Rubalcaba. We recently spoke with Miami International Jazz Fest producer Arturo Campa at the WLRN studios. Arturo Campa, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat.
Thank you very much, Bob. Finally get to meet you in person after knowing you for so long. Yeah, it's a gas, man. It's a gas.
Absolutely. I'm a lot taller in person.
Yeah, and a lot better looking, too, than I thought. You know, the photograph and the link didn't do you much justice. No.
Well, anyway, we have the first Miami International Jazz Fest coming up. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the genesis of this project. How did this all start?
Basically, it's an evolution of my ideas as far as presenting jazz that were born early in 1976. It's been developing little by little. It started then we went to the Miami Latin Jazz Festival to benefit Gusman Center, then my associate production of the JVC Jazz Festival in 2001 and beyond. And it has never stopped, and now we have been able to establish this nonprofit organization to do not only this, but a year-round situation related to youth and the teaching of music and trying to channel the young men and women in this county that may want to become professional musicians.
Yes, I saw that on your website, that mm-hmm. there was a component, a youth competition with youth, young musicians.
Youth talent competition intended at to shine the light on those that want to, like I said, go further in a music career. It doesn't have to be one particular talent. It could be singing, it could be playing, it could be, you know, different things, and see how we can channel that into their future. And by aiding their pass to second education with a scholarship of $500. It's not a lot of money. That's what we can afford at this time. But that's just the beginning of our program dealing with youth, you know.
It's all helpful.
Yeah, indeed it is. Yeah.
And speaking of deep talent, certainly your lineup for the Miami International Jazz Fest has some very, very great talent. We were talking before about Jerry Gonzalez and the Fort Apache Band.
Yes.
And Giovanni Hidalgo mm-hmm. And Atlanti. Now, I understand that you and those gentlemen also have a similar background, a connection through Eddie Palmieri.
The beginning band, Jerry Gonzalez and the Four Apache Band, the Gonzalez brothers, one on bass and obviously Jerry on percussion, they were members of the same Eddie Palmieri band that I was in as a vocalist. So indeed, went on for a year, a couple of years. You know, the different members of that band changed at one time or another, but we did share the stage for at least a year and a half. And from there, you know, we recorded certain things together, and we went on to establish a long-lasting relationship. And I've had the pleasure of bringing them down to Miami early on, back to the Lincoln Theater, I can remember, in 95, and then to the Gusman Center. And they haven't been back since then. But they're a six-time Grammy-nominated group. Well, what can I tell you about that?
And amazing.
And their approach to music is unique.
We were talking before about Steve Berrios, the drummer, sadly passed away last year. But we have somebody coming with the Fort Apache Band who's not a bad replacement.
No. Jeff Tane Watts. Yeah, is coming in his place. And, well, you know, Steve was an original member of that band. But this guy is definitely not a pushover in that seat. And so that group is just as strong as ever. Joe Ford on sax, Larry Willis on piano, Tane on drums, Jerry Gonzalez on trumpet and percussion, and his brother Andy on bass.
And those guys have been playing together for 30-some years now. So.
And they have a lot of records. They're constantly appearing throughout the world, Europe, Far East, constantly making appearances. And so, no doubt about it, they're top shelf A-listers, without a doubt.
Yeah, no question. And also, we were talking before about their great mix of Afro-Caribbean jazz and also straight-ahead hard bop, if you
bebop. The integration of the group itself, this fusion of jazz traditions that are a tremendous sound that they have accomplished, you know. And
yes,
it's really an outstanding presentation, without a doubt.
Sure. And our other alumni from the Palmieri Band, Giovanni Hidalgo.
The Palmieri Band can at times be considered a lab for good talent. I was the least talented of all. Giovanni of a different generation, and who's turned out to be a tremendous percussionist, world famous. And what can I tell you? Everybody recognizes him as the best there is right now.
Yeah, no question. I've seen him in San Juan before at the Heineken Jazz Fest. And he's so exciting. And he mixes a lot of different styles.
Yes, he does.
Some from Cuba, some from Puerto Rico. And
a professor at Berklee College, also a multiple Grammy winner, an endorsee of LP percussion instruments.
And can you tell us about the band Atlantique?
Atlante is his own. He calls it Atlante because it's finally coming into his own project. He's been a collaborator in a lot of different projects, but now he's doing this with some of the guys that were originally with Batacumbele, who was his starting band in Puerto Rico, a tremendous Latin jazz group. And those are his, should I say, comfort zone players.
Sure.
And the rhythm. Yeah. So he's relying on his hunchos.
That all's going to be very exciting.
I think so, too.
That's our Saturday night program. So for Friday night, we've got some of our hometown heroes.
Well, don't forget Saturday night, we have Mike Orta Trio also.
Yes, that's just what I was going to talk about.
Mike and his brother, Mick, and Carlos Magno Araya.
Yeah.
So on drums, that's going to be the opening act, and what an opening act for you. I mean, you know, when you open with something like that, you wonder what the end is going to be like.
So Mike and Nikki and Carlo Magno,
Mike
Orta Trio.
Right.
And I guess Friday night we've got Abel Pabon, who a lot of South Florida
another
jazz
Grammy
fans
winner.
Will know.
He won a Grammy with Nestor Torres as a composer. And that's Friday night at the Little Haiti Cultural Arts Center. Abel Pabon and his own stuff called Crossroads. And then the local favorites, Spam All Stars, that have become a group that travels all over the states and out of the country in festivals and whatnot.
Sure. Well, Arturo, we've got these wonderful venues, both in South Miami and in Little Haiti, so people can get a taste of what's going on in both of those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hoping that there will be additional editions, I should say, of the Miami International Jazz Fest.
We definitely think so. My fondest dream is when I pass away, there'll be written in my tombstone, the Little Festival That Could. You know, that means that we're growing this year for the first time, but we intend to expand and we intend to bring to Miami a world-class festival that not only the locals can enjoy, but to become an attraction for all jazz lovers throughout the world. You know, that's our approach to this whole thing. Yeah, definitely.
Sure. Well, we're certainly looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
Arturo Campa, thank you so much for joining us on South Florida Arts Beat.
Indeed, my pleasure, and I'd like to thank you for the people involved in our organization for giving us the opportunity to bring the message out to your listeners and to the listeners of the station.
The Miami International Jazz Festival begins at 8 p.m. on May 9th at the Little Haiti Cultural Arts Center at 212 Northeast 59th Terrace and continues at 8 p.m. May 10th at the South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center at 10950 Southwest 211th Street in Cutler Bay. For more information, call 305-491-3588 or visit miamiinternationaljazzfest.org. You can also find information at smdcac.org or call 786-573-5300. This is Bob Weinberg for South Florida Arts Beat.
Bob Weinberg is a writer and editor for Jazz Is Magazine and the online publication Jazz and Blues Florida. You can contact him at bobweinberg@mac.com. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will continue here on WLRN and WKWM in just a moment. Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Ed Bell with you. And now, Chef Norman Van Aken gives us a word on food.
I don't want French fried potatoes, red ripe tomatoes. I'm never satisfied. I want the frim-fram sauce with the offs and fade, with shafafa on the side. Shoo-doo-dee-doo-ya-doo-doo.
Hi, I'm Norman Van Aken, and welcome to A Word on Food. Today's word on food is culinary couples. You and me, darling, like ham and eggs, like cream and sugar. You know what I mean, love? Like Bogey and Bacall, some things are meant to be unified, a oneness out of two. It is the way of the world. When I think of the great food marriages, I swirl in a dance of dualities. Salt and pepper, peanut butter and jelly, chocolate and vanilla. What causes some things to match so perfectly that we rarely think of them as alone? That their still stunning singularity is magnified by more than a power of two when twined. The magic is in their differences, I'm sure. It is often noted in human love affairs that opposites attract, but we often see how these opposites change in our relentlessly evolving and inescapable human ways. Unlike food, we never stop morphing, but as near as I can tell, the great food matchups remain constants through very long periods of time. I feel reasonably assured that when Mark Twain had a breakfast of biscuits and gravy, it would be quite similar to a properly made rendition of the same in this century. Of course, any damn fool can play with the properties of food, and many will. Some might make biscuits out of potatoes, and gravy out of emulsified pea soup. Egads! But I guarantee it won't create a line to a table like my friend Natalie Dupre's version. I can lay claim to knowing a thing or two about fusion cooking. I have not gotten into that topic much during my weekly programs of A Word on Food. There is not enough room, honestly, for the full range of things I have to say within this time frame. Google me if you want more. But I will take the time to say that what struck me cooking in the early years is how many fitting unions one could make if the chef was not shy about some border crossing. And I was not shy. I will wait for history as long as I can, but when I fused a smoky plantain cream sauce with my pork Havana, I hit some kind of cross-cultural nerve. I know because many of the chefs who once worked for me continue to do versions in the restaurants they now cook in. I am happy about it, actually. Flattery and respect can be partners, too. For my wife Janet's and my anniversary, we decided to go to a celebratory restaurant that we have loved over the decades and have a true feast. The pairings in that dinner included classic unions of oysters and sauce mignonette, foie gras and sauternes, heirloom tomato fondue with gnocchi, brook trout and almonds, steak and béarnaise. At the end of all that, we asked for the cheese cart and enjoyed a meltingly proper epoisse made with cow's milk, as it has been since the early 1500s by Cistercian monks in the Burgundian village of Epoisse, with homemade fig marmalade. After some resting time, the restaurant sent out their justifiably famous old-fashioned chocolate cake with creme anglaise. I looked at her in the magical glow of that dining room after the end of that meal, and I asked her if we had it all. She smiled at me with the chocolate frosting still on her lips and said with a wink, just like Bogie and Bacall. I'm Norman Van Aken, and that's my word on food.
Norman Van Aken is the author of My Key West and is also the director of restaurants for the Miami Culinary Institute and Tuyo in downtown Miami. Please tune in tomorrow morning at 8:34 on Weekend Edition to hear Peppers. And here's our South Florida Arts Beat entertainment calendar. And today we welcome back Andy Newman of the Florida Keys and Key West Tourism Council. Andy, tell us about the fabulous Florida Keys.
And it's always great to be with you. Let's talk about a couple of ongoing events, such as in Key West, the 6th annual Key West Art Garden. Now, the cost to the Key West, the Tropical Forest and Botanical Garden, which is where the venue is, also includes the opportunity to take a look at 19 sculptures, each made of recycled materials, some that are interactive, and all placed throughout the garden from local contemporary artists. By the way, the garden's open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. daily. Also in Key West, through June 30th, the Key West Art and Historical Society is presenting Marky Person, Night Visions in Technicolor. Marky is a local artist and graphic designer, and he has new paintings and designs that are focusing on three distinct categories, including Conch Night series featuring the Hemingway House, Custom House, and Curry Mansion. By the way, the Key West Art and Historical Society's exhibitions are always at the Custom House Museum, located at 281 French Street. It's also featuring, through September 30th, Key West or Bust. It's a history of tourism in the Florida Keys, tracing back to the Great Depression of the 1930s to modern times. Finally, down in Key West, as we move to events coming up this weekend through May the 4th, the Key West Paddleboard Classic. It's an ocean board paddleboard race where participants will enjoy a challenging 12-mile course over crystal blue water, circling Key West through scenic mangroves and passing by the historic Seaport District, and so much more. And Ed, this weekend up in Key Largo, the Humphrey Bogart Film Festival. In fact, it's the second annual Humphrey Bogart Film Festival. It'll screen a rotating selection of Bogie classics and also a group of movies centered around the festival's theme of romance. Now, of course, this festival celebrates the life and films of the man the American Film Institute named America's greatest male screen legend. Great thing, by the way, Ed, about the Humphrey Bogart Film Festival. Of course, it is set in one of Bogart's most famous films, aptly named Key Largo. Also in Key Largo, the African Queen, the original African Queen from that movie. Great thing, visitors can actually come down and take a ride on the African Queen. By the way, Stephen Bogart, the son of Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, will be at the festival, and also some notable folks like Leonard Maltin and actress Olivia Thirlby. Add to two other events this weekend. First of all, tonight down in Key West, from 5:30 p.m. to 8 o'clock at the Key West Lighthouse Museum, celebrate Women of the Lighthouse, a great presentation that focuses on women lighthouse keepers. And a fabulous event down in Key West tomorrow night, the Key Stock Music Festival. It'll be at the Truman Waterfront, starts at 6 p.m., and it features the Doobie Brothers.
Wow.
And Lower Keys musical favorite Howard Livingston and the Mile Marker 24 Band. And they had two productions going on in Key West. First of all, May 6th to the 24th, the Waterfront Playhouse presenting A Dog Story, and the Red Barn Theater presenting Short Attention Span Theater's Happy Meals. That's from May 6th to the 31st. Down in Key West on May 7th, the South Florida Symphony presenting the Blue Door String Quartet. Big event in Key West, May 7th to the 11th, next week, the Key West Songwriters Festival. It's a 19th annual showcase of musical magic featuring America's foremost performing songwriters. There's concert stage and intimate audience-friendly island settings, and also a very large street concert next Saturday on Duval Street in front of Sloppy Joe's and Rick's. Other events throughout May at Marathon, May 8th to the 24th, the Marathon Community Theater presenting Marrying Terry. Also, May 11th up in Alamorada, the 20th annual Bay Jam. It's a music and art festival that features local and guest artists performing on the beautiful shores of Florida Bay at the amphitheater at Founders Park, mile marker 87, and it is a free event. Key Largo's Original Music Festival, May 15th to the 18th, at different on-the-water venues. There's unique singers and local entertainers. It's being presented by the Upper Keys Business Group in Alamorada, May 15th. It's a Thursday. The Morada Way Arts and Cultural District presents the Third Thursday Art Walk. May 16th to the 17th in Key West, the 12th Annual Harry S. Truman Legacy Symposium. It's Key West's annual political history highlighted in panel discussions and reception and tours of the Little White House, where Harry Truman spent 11 working vacations during his presidency. Big ultra marathon coming up May 17th to the 18th down throughout the entire Florida Keys. It's the Keys 100 Ultra Marathon Race, benefits the Cancer Foundation of the Florida Keys. And finally, Ed, the History of Diving Museum honors military divers. That's May 21st through the 26th. History of Diving Museum, a fascinating place in Alamorada that traces the historical evolution of man's quest to discover and to explore the underwater environment. If you've never been in there, you've got to take a look at it because it is just fabulous. Of course, much more information on these and so many other events in the fabulous Florida Keys on the Florida Keys website, and it's flakeys.com, Ed.
Andy Newman always has great event information for us for the fabulous Florida Keys. Andy, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ed, too.
Cantare. The Miami Children's Chorus will be in concert with Nestor Torres and guest artists Dr. David L. Bruner and Dance Now Miami Mother's Day, Sunday, May the 11th at 5 p.m. at the New World Center, 517th Street on Miami Beach. For more information, you can call the Miami Children's Chorus at 305-662-7494 or go to their website at miamichildrenschorus.org. And tonight, there's a free concert at the Hollywood Beach Bandshell featuring Diller Jazz. And they are giving their final performance before they travel to New York to compete at the Essentially Ellington competition. Showtime starts tonight at 7:30. Admission is free at the Hollywood Beach Theater at Johnson Street and the Ocean. We'll rebroadcast South Florida Arts Beat tonight and every Friday night at 7 p.m. on our WLRN Extra HD channel. You can tune in on your HD radio or go to our website at WLRN.org for more information. And that's today's edition of South Florida Arts Beat. We hope you enjoyed the show. I'm Ed Bell, producer and host. Our theme was composed by Mike Levine and performed by Mike and Sam Levine. Paul Leary is our online producer. Thanks as well to our technical director today, Andy Wagner, and our contributors, Dan Hudak, Bob Weinberg, Norman Van Aken, and Andy Newman. Please call us with your comments, 305-995-2258. You can fax us your event information, 305-995-2221, or email it to us at info@wlrn.org. We'd like to hear from you. Monday at this time, Topical Currents with hosts Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, Monday at 1 o'clock. Have yourself a great weekend, and please, as always, keep your dial set right here to 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Until next time, this is Ed Bell saying bye-bye. Enjoy.